Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our discussion about the GOP's public media cuts, which will cause KALW to lose $400,000 a year for the next 2 years. We have received an outpouring of support since the final vote was announced. If you would like to support KALW, go to kalw.org and click donate or support your member station, and we are all so grateful for your support. Now, Republicans have tried to cut this funding for decades. Donald Trump made it happen. How did he do it, and what does this mean for the future of public media? We'll also discuss the administration's ongoing assault on the press and major media outlets capitulating to his threats. What will it take for a free and independent press to survive? Today, we're joined by two guests. Allison Perlman is Associate Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Film and Media Studies, Associate Professor in the Department of History, and Chair of the Council on Educational Policy at the University of California, Irvine. Allison Perlman is also author of the book Public Interests, Media Advocacy, and Struggles Over U.S. Television. Hi, Allison. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. Joseph Torres is Senior Advisor for Reparative Policy and Programs at Free Press, an organization that was created to give people a voice in the crucial decisions that shape our media. Joseph advises Free Press staff in setting and evaluating Free Press and Media 2070 policy positions and priorities. Media 2070 works to radically transform who has the capital to tell their own stories by 2070. It seeks to highlight how the media can serve as a lever for racial justice and underscore the repair and reconciliation necessary to build strong, free, and democratic communities. Joseph Torres is co-author of the book News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. He co-authored that book with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. Hi, Joe. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. I really wanted to do another show about these cuts because I feel at a time when so much is happening, we tend to move on from a huge breaking story to go to the next one. But these cuts are so monumental. And to think that Republicans have tried to do this for decades, and it took Donald Trump to make it happen. Allison, you look at the history of the media. Can you just talk about just how big this is, that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting is going to lose $1.1 billion, which will hurt community stations and tribal stations the most?
Sure. And I'm so glad that you mentioned that this has been a longstanding Republican priority pretty much since public broadcasting was created by the Public Broadcasting Act in 1967. So as early as 1972, President Richard Nixon vetoed congressional appropriations for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This sent panic across the sector, and it led to leaders in the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to step down, which provided an opportunity for Nixon to install folks who he saw more aligned with his vision of what public media should be to take leadership of the sector. And after that, he approved an annual appropriation for public media. Ronald Reagan in the 1980s tried very hard to defund public broadcasting. He ultimately failed, although he did reduce congressional appropriations, and it led also to a fairly substantial transformation within public media, where local stations, NPR, PBS, increasingly were encouraged to rely on private sources of support, especially corporate underwriting. Congressional Republicans in the 1990s created a plan to defund public media across 3 years. And this also failed mostly because they received a tremendous amount of pushback from local communities. So the fact that it's actually happened, I think, is shocking because we've been through this dance so many times before of threats to federal funding, but ultimately Congress has voted to approve money for the sector. And so it is somewhat catastrophic that this rescission bill passed last week. And as you mentioned, the elements of the sector that that will be most devastated will be local stations, especially in rural communities, who don't have the same access to a broad population base or affluent listeners or viewers that can help offset these federal cuts.
Joe, that's the other really important aspect of all of this, is to think about the word public and public media. It's easy to forget that we're talking about information that is free to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. I think it's easy to forget that because we are all so inundated with information. But in order to get the cable shows or whatever you're talking about, documentaries, people have to pay for it. Public media is free and available to everyone. And I think in this media world we're living in now, it's really easy to forget that.
Absolutely. And, you know, the tragic part about all this is that while Trump is attacking, he defunded Voice of America, right? Other attacks on the media, and what he's done to defunding of the PBS and NPR with these clawback cuts, is public media is severely underfunded to begin with. Right. You know, compared to what other countries spend on public media, and you can correlate the health of a public media system with, and studies have shown this, with the health of a democracy, right? Of a democracy in public engagement in other countries. And so we critically underinvest in public media historically. It serves a critically important role, and it needs to be, it's always been a struggle just to keep it at its level. I mean, I was just reading an article the other day, for instance, there's 12 HBCUs, I believe, that have public radio stations. But meanwhile, this is also within the context that HBCUs have been historically underfunded, and the number of HBCUs has been shrinking. And so places, institutions, universities and others that have places that have a public operate public radio stations, even the infrastructure for organizations to be able to operate a public radio station, even that infrastructure is being weakened, and I'll stop here, is that this is also part of a larger goal of the Trump administration going after universities and any place where meaning is made, the idea of meaning, and how to shift, you could say narrative, but shift what people understand, the meaning in which they get out of information to make sense of the world they live in. And so we're always contending over meaning and how we understand what's going on in our lives. And media is a critically important place where we make meaning, and because it shapes culture. And he's attacking those places where, in an effort to make sure meaning is fixed in the way that he wants it to be fixed, and his administration, to continue to go at places where he is adversarial to what he believes, what he in his political goals and narrative strategy, in order to be able to accomplish his larger goals at hand. So
right. And we'll talk about those larger goals throughout the show. Joe, to your point about how much we spend in the United States versus other countries. So we're talking about taxpayer dollars here. I've seen a couple different numbers, everything between $1.60 per person and about $3 per person in the United States per person on public broadcasting. Compare that to Germany at $142, Norway $110. I'll go down, France $75, Botswana $18. But here in the US, it's about $1 to $3 per person. And so, as you say, we are woefully underfunding public media outlets. Allison, it's also important to note, you wrote a piece in The Conversation with Josh Shepard from the University of Colorado, and you pointed out that The CPB has always approved and designated funds 2 years in advance due to a provision in the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 after Congress voted to provide that money. So the Republican Party went to, you know, they embraced unprecedented rules to change all of this through this rescission vote. So even though the funds were there, they clawed them back. And it's rare that that happens. So can you talk more about that? Because, you know, a lot of people in the public media world up until about a month ago, they did not think this was going to pass.
Yeah, well, so one of the biggest questions that has hovered over the public broadcasting sector for decades is how do you provide federal funding in a way that insulates public broadcasters from political interference? The original vision of the Carnegie Commission on Educational Television, which was created in the mid-1960s to figure out how to address just the poverty and financial precarity of public broadcasting. And they, the Carnegie Commission, was the group that recommended sustained federal funding. Their vision was, why don't we put a tax on television sets? And the money that the federal government receives from that tax will go into an insulated fund, and that will support public media. And when the Johnson administration and Congress considered what became the Public Broadcasting Act, this provision of the Carnegie recommendations was removed. And it's clear that even at the time, there was this enormous anxiety that if funding for public media went through the political appropriations process, members of Congress or the White House might try to interfere with the content of public radio and television stations. Unfortunately, when the bill passed, no one really knew how they were going to square that circle. They, you know, they dedicated money, they created the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, but this question of how to prevent political interference went unanswered. By the mid-1970s, Congress finally tackles this issue by deciding that public broadcasting appropriations are going to happen multiple years in advance. So Congress will authorize funding, they'll appropriate money, first it was 5 years in advance, then 3 years, then 2 years, with the hope that if the money is already appropriated in the future, if a member of Congress doesn't like what's happening on NPR in the moment or what's happening on PBS, it ostensibly should not affect future funding because the funds have already been appropriated by Congress. And so exactly as you say, Rose, the money that's being rescinded right now had already been approved on a bipartisan basis to support public media for the next 2 years. It was already approved. And so I think there always is this hovering anxiety, what if our appropriations get cut in the future? Or what if there's another push to defund public media? But my sense is everyone thought they had a little bit of a cushion because this money had already been provided. And so the fact that the Trump administration put forward a rescission bill to claw back money that had already been appropriated was somewhat stunning. This action is pretty consistent with the recommendations in Project 2025 over how to address public media, which recommended both defunding it and going after local radio and television station licenses. And we can see that pretty much the minute that the Trump administration took office, they're pursuing both of these tacks to attack public media, get rid of the funding, and go after local licenses.
And the effects are going to be devastating for stations across the country. I just want to read a couple quotes here. We talked about these cuts last week with Loris Taylor, president and CEO of Native Public Media, and they work with a number of tribal stations across the country. And I asked her about an interview I heard on the PBS NewsHour with Francine Blythe Lewis, who is CEO of the Native American video programming producer Vision Maker Media. She said, for Indian country in general, 80% of the communities are rural, and their only access to national news, native story sharing, community news, whatever it is through PBS stations or public radio. If the clawback happens, I would say a good 90% of those stations will cease to exist. And Loris Taylor agreed with that on our show. So that is absolutely devastating, Joe, to think that 90% of Native stations might cease to exist. And this is the only news that people in these rural areas receive on a regular basis?
Yeah, I mean, within that fact that Loris is addressing, it lies within a contradiction, to be quite honest. You know, the contradiction is like we here to defend public media because it's critically important to our society, but at the same time, public media has also struggled to serve the needs of Black folks, Latino, Indigenous folks, and other communities that have not historically been as well served by public media. That's been the story over the past 50 years or more with when it comes to mainstream media, public media. And so the fact that it's this like the whole public media system as we've seen was it's this fragile. But even public, but for tribal communities, it's even that more fragile. In other communities that are don't have within their own communities a lack of news and a lack of information and news resources to be able to get this information from the media ecosystem. It's the challenges that continue to exist within the media ecosystem because if something could be this fragile. And it's a critical source of nuisance information that it's going to really harm a community. It just also shows like that the work has not been completed in trying to create and with discussing this with the you know with the with public media and the idea is not being funded like the way it should be funded. How all about you know how media ecosystem and institutions, especially public media. Like it's always lived a life of uncertainty in so many ways, you know, about its future, always fighting for, there's never been certain that like Allison said, it's always been past, right? Even though threats to it, but we shouldn't have to contend to fighting for just to keep it existing. And we should be able to fight to expand public media. To more fully serve the health and information needs of so many marginalized communities. This is I guess what we have to think about as we try to win back and fight for the future of public media and how to not just get back what we lost, but also to how to expand it at the same time. So within Loris's quote exists, it's unbelievably harmful to tribal communities, but it also exists the challenges within public media that were not fully addressed in the first place.
And Allison, Politico has a piece called Frustration and Fear Ripple Through NPR and PBS Affiliates after this vote. Don Dunlap, president and general manager of KEDT, a public radio and TV station in Corpus Christi, Texas, said, "I think lawmakers' decisions were not informed. We're there to help people. There are 10 public TV stations in Texas, and we're thinking six of them will shut down within a year." I mean, this is incredible. 10 public TV stations in Texas, and six are going to shut down in the next 6 months? Or, I'm sorry, the next year?
Yeah, it's staggering and shocking. You know, without a doubt. I mean, I think that in the past, you know, there's often been a hostility to national public media, and I think NPR and PBS often get the lion's share of criticism, especially from the political right, over especially perceived bias in its programming. But often, what has saved public media has been really two things. First, children's programming, which for decades has been seen as tremendously valuable to the public, you know, shows like Sesame Street or Mr. Rogers and so on. And then the other thing that's always really saved public media, and this dates back even to the 1950s, is that even when conservative politicians might have critiques of nationally circulating programming, they have really valued the local service provided to their communities, the educational programming, the cultural programming, the community programming. And so it has often been a way to balance out these anxieties over national public media with the seen benefits of local public media. And so I think the quotation that you read really speaks to maybe members of Congress not taking stock of how valuable public television and radio is to their constituents when we look at the local programming provided to communities.
Well, and like you say, the Republicans had a hearing on this. They wanted to get their soundbite clip in, and they were really going after NPR. NPR did announce this week that they are going to implement $8 million in cuts and then distribute that money to stations that are in need. But this is really going to affect the community stations, the tribal stations, the public TV stations. The other thing I want to point out, and I want to have another show with documentary filmmakers, because so many of them rely on this funding. They rely on PBS to get these incredible films out there. And I just have to call out something. I don't know if you two remember this during the hearing, but I was really struck by, I've never heard of this representative before, Representative William Timmons from South Carolina. He was asking the PBS CEO at this hearing if trees are racist. And he kept repeating this line. And I thought, what is this guy talking about? And so I looked it up. So there's a documentary out called Racist Trees, and it's about a black neighborhood in Palm Springs fighting to remove a divisive wall of trees. And I'll just shout this documentary out because I really want to see it now. It says, "Were trees intentionally planted to exclude and segregate a black neighborhood? Racial tensions ignite in this documentary when a historically black neighborhood in Palm Springs, California, fights to remove a towering wall of tamarisk trees. The trees form a barrier believed by some to segregate the community, frustrating residents who regard them as an enduring symbol of racism." So, Allison, this is sounds like such an important documentary. And here's this congressman just making a joke out of it, saying, "Are trees racist?" And the PBS CEO, you could also tell, had no idea what the guy was talking about. I mean, she just looked at him like, "What do you mean?" So it was almost a mockery. They're making a mockery out of public media. Paula Kirker, I'm sorry, is the CEO of PBS. And it just wasn't serious. But the consequences of these actions are going to have so, it's just going to weigh so heavy in so many communities across this country.
Yeah, I will note that often attacks on especially public television programming is coming from members of Congress who have not actually watched the programs that they're tarring as biased or inappropriate or ridiculous, as you're sort of suggesting with this documentary, which I also agree sounds really amazing and I would love to watch it. And so it's I think, been so baked into conservative politics for so many decades that the public media sector has a liberal or left-leaning tilt. And there have been a number of studies both to resist this characterization, and it also has overshadowed, and I think Joe was getting to this earlier, that there have been a lot of critiques of public media from the left too, really important ones about which communities it serves, who it imagines as its ideal audience, the way that it's responded to conservative attacks by tacking more to the right. But it's almost become just an article of faith for the right that public media is absurdly liberal, even though many of the claims they're making against the sector are entirely uninformed by actual programming practices. And I just want to underline something else that you said, Rose, which is public broadcasting, public television has been one of the most important sites for supporting and showing documentary films since the 1960s. And these cuts are going to be devastating to the documentary community, who's both relied on the independent television service for funding for their projects and for public television to get a national audience for their work. So that is another community of people who will really be hurt by this rescission bill.
It's so true. I'm really curious to find out how this is going to affect Independent Lens. I mean, the documentaries that they put out are so good. A lot of people are talking about this documentary, Life After, A filmmaker investigates assisted dying, focusing on the disabled voices missing from the debate. So many important films here, and we're definitely going to do a show about this. Joe, what would you like to add before we go to break?
Yeah, no, it's just the fact that he's injecting, like, he's using race to try to embarrass or injure the funding of public media. It just shows, like, it's the Trump administration since they've gotten in, and like how DEI and race has been used to really try to wipe away institutions, you know, and critical institutions and government policies that serve communities. And so it might have been flippant. I saw that on online, and I didn't go down the, so thank you for putting the context of what he was referring to. Again, it sounds like an awesome documentary, but yeah. it was like, it's just how casual and easily race is used to the funding of important critical institutions like NPR and PBS and public radio stations and television stations across the country. So it's just the cruelty of it all.
Well, we are going to take a quick break. That is Joseph Torres, Senior Advisor for Reparative Policy and Programs at Free Press. He advises Free Press staff in evaluating Media 2070. They work to radically transform who has the capital to tell their own stories. Joe is also co-author of a great book, News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. He co-authored it with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez. We're also joined by Allison Perlman, Associate Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Film and Media Studies, Associate Professor in the Department of History, and Chair of the Council on Educational Policy at UC Irvine. Allison Perlman is author of the book Public Interests, Media Advocacy and Struggles Over U.S. Television. And today we're continuing our discussion about the Republican Party's public media cuts, which will cause KALW to lose $400,000 a year over the next 2 years. And this is the first time I was checking out this Politico article about what these cuts will mean. And according to Don Dunlap, GM of KEDT in Corpus Christi, out of 10 public TV stations in Texas, he says six will shut down within a year. So these cuts are really going to affect people all across this country. If you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on what we are seeing? What do you think about public media? Has this changed the way you think about media, given that so much is at stake? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, New York Times White House correspondent Tyler Page will join us to talk about his new book, 2024, How Trump Retook the White House and Democrats Lost America. Page and his co-authors ask, how did the first U.S. president to become a convicted felon regain control of the White House, and at what cost? Where did the Biden and Harris campaigns go wrong? They have a lot of detail in this book, and I hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation, our ongoing conversations about the GOP's public media cuts and what they mean for independent journalism that is available for everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. I think it's so important to focus on that this is free. I mean, you just need a radio to listen to this information. And it is so important that we have something like this, where people do not have to pay a monthly subscription. Of course, we so appreciate your contributions to stations like KALW. Some people aren't not available at the moment. They don't have the means to pay, and that's okay. It's still available. But if you do have the means to support our station, we so appreciate it. You can do that by going to kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Allison Perlman, Associate Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Film and Media Studies at UC Irvine, and author of Public Interests, Media Advocacy and Struggles Over U.S. Television. Joe Torres, a Senior Advisor for Reparative Policy and Programs at Free Press. He advises Free Press staff in setting and evaluating media 2070 policy positions. They're working to radically transform who has the capital to tell their own stories. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Bill in Novato. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I just sent an email to your call, kind of backing up what I'm saying here. And basically, what NPR stations could do in any area could become a political force, basically be a seed for a political force in that area. You had in this local, the last bill that just passed, all these Republicans voted to defund NPR stations. Well, if those NPR stations were a political force that those politicians feared, because those NPR stations were cultivating a local political force and community by having events said, you know, that they would tell their listeners, hey, we're having an event this Saturday to inform about, you know, some important issue, and basically get a build up a political force, and that force would support the station and also defeat these Republicans in these areas. The Republicans could do that, congressmen and people, because they don't fear the community there. There's no community being built up there, and the NPR stations could do that instead of being, you know, neutral. You know, things that are not politically active or strong, they need to help themselves and help the community by being a seed of a political community. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And if you're not aware, KLW has so many events at our 220 Montgomery Street space in San Francisco. There's a lot coming up tonight at 7. There's going to be a segment on psychedelics tomorrow at 7, SF Mind Troupe, July 25th, 5:30, open mic. Hanna Baba is doing an incredible event, Folk Tales from Sudan, on Saturday at 2. There's so many events happening. I understand what you're saying, and I think it's important to note that in Alaska, I mean, again, a state with a lot of rural stations where people get emergency information from their public media station. They lobbied Senator Murkowski very hard on this issue. And she actually voted against it in the end. It was in the Senate, it was Murkowski and Collins who voted against it. McConnell voted against moving the bill forward, but in the end, he voted for it. So it wasn't a tie. So in that case, some of these stations got to Murkowski. I don't know what happened behind the scenes, but I know that these stations really raised their voices because they have so much to lose, especially in rural areas of Alaska, getting critical information about weather and things like that. So thank you for the call, Bill. We have a caller who didn't want to stay on the line. Many, if not most, people are not going to the radio. Can broadcasters give out radios? You know, that's a great point. It's interesting in this world now where people find us on podcasts and listen over their computer. We wonder how people listen to us. I know a lot of people still do probably listen on the radio, but a lot more people are listening on their computer. So that's another thing to think about, is how people actually find public radio. I want to read a few emails. Stephen writes, let's put it into simple terms. Trump is attacking sources of truth so he can spread his toxic lies without opposition. Howard writes, here is proof that our crisis in democracy is in fact a crisis in capitalism. Capitalism concentrates power in the hands of the few. Democracy wants power distributed equally among all individuals. Under Trump, capital is being pulled away from institutions that serve the people as individuals, education, and news. Historically, the nation's information networks have been owned by capitalist corporations. Public media was established to attempt a balance. We must rally together as we the people make radical change. The Democratic Party is not helping. We have another email from Steve. When conservatives accuse public media of liberal bias, what they really mean is their bias toward facts and truth. Conservatism has become detached from facts, for example, the reality of human-caused climate change, because of their love of profit and greed. Tony writes, I'm listening. You had me intrigued with the documentary on racist trees. I checked it out, and here's the link. Thanks for the amazing programming. You know, Tony, I actually invited the filmmakers from Racist Trees on. And so I really hope they can join us, because I really want to have some documentary filmmakers on to talk about how they'll be affected by these cuts. Sandra writes, huge shout out to KALW, especially the training programs like the Audio Academy. Thank you for that. For those who do not know, we have been offering this Audio Academy for many years, and so many aspiring journalists, people who are interested in journalism, come through KALW and learn about all aspects of radio, and then they go on to do amazing things. Some of them are still at KALW after many, many years, and some are at other outlets doing incredible work. So that is also important, these training programs. A couple more emails. Thank you for all these great emails. Art writes, the Trump administration is doing everything in its power to operate in the dark so the people of this country will have less access to information and make intelligent decisions. We the people must act through our members of Congress and directly through expanded fundraising to counter this attack on an essential element of our democracy. Freedom of speech on the airwaves must not be allowed to shrivel and die, not on our watch. Well, thank you for that, Art. Joe, would you like to respond to any of those emails? And one thing that is not getting enough attention throughout all of these conversations on cuts to public media, how is this going to affect diversity in public media?
Yeah, you know, this was some great comments, you know. So the idea of the person ask about, like, basically asking how do folks in public media advocate, I took it as like advocating and enlisting the community to advocate to support the mission of public media. I interpreted that with his statement in that kind of way. And the thing is, it's like, that is, I think there's some validity in how, I think the crisis in journalism over the past almost 20 years now, you know, the pace of public media has always been in, has resulted in more and more journalists realizing that they have to engage in policy. And it may not be the let's say, everyday working journalists, but maybe there are institutions that represent journalists, who represent journalists on First Amendment issues, also have to expand their advocacy on policy, because otherwise other people are going to be speaking on behalf of journalists. And so there needs to be like more of a, there is more happening of more and more journalists speaking out and supporting policies to support journalism policies in states and stuff like that to fund journalism. And so it's a more newer development. And I like, you know, I think there's a stake in it. You know, the journalists have a stake in it, but more importantly, the community has a stake in that the outcome results in journalism that's actually serving the community and the continuation of local news to be able to serve the health needs of the community. And I mentioned advocacy because I have a friend of mine who is almost finishing almost done with a documentary called Barrio Television, where local activists took over the PBS station in New York City in 1972 or 73. In order to get more Latinos on the air, and it resulted in the first national public affairs television show for Latinos called Realidades, you know, that lasted for like 5 years. And so there has been advocacy, and a lot of these folks were journalists, right? So there's been advocacy within Black and Brown communities to address the failure of our media system, including public media, to address the needs of the community. And so I didn't, the bigger question you had, and I'll finish here, is like, yeah, so imagine what would be the first to go, right? Mm-hmm. What are the stations and institutions that don't have as much resources, are not as well financed or resource to continue to produce programming? And so you can only imagine that it's gonna be Black and stations that serve Black and brown communities. And then also, what does it mean for the hiring of Black and brown folks by NPR and PBS stations or public radio stations when there's such an attack on DEI? It's just a cover for like that anything, if Black and brown folks are present, it represents some sort of illegal hire, someone who's not inherently qualified. So like, and so the back and away in that, because public media, because of what Allison talked about, the idea of the wasn't a funding mechanism to sustain its, you know, like its sustainability in a way where it's outside of political protection, is been in corporate underwriting for public media, which places a lot of pressure, which makes it I think harder to deal with some of the structural issues when it comes to race and stuff like that within a PBS system, you know, and a public media system. So I'll stop there.
Allison, would you like to respond to any of the listener comments and then talk about what this means for diversity in the media?
Sure. I thought the comments were excellent. And I just want to underline something that Joe had said earlier that also came out in the comments, which I think we are seeing a wholesale attack right now on expertise, both the attacks on public media, but also the sustained attacks on higher education that started this year as well, both under the veneer of combating anti-Semitism, but the canceling of federal loans for research at a number of universities, and just the very deliberate attacks on research institutions, is, I think, part and parcel of a broader attack on knowledge and expertise right now. And so when we look back at what happened in 2024, I think that will be one of the primary frames that historians will use to make sense of this concerted attack against the media and against education. You know, something that Joe touched on, which I think is really important, is that public media has often struggled to really be representative of the publics that local stations serve. And this has been a longstanding critique of the sector. And there have been efforts, you know, it varies from community to community, but one of the struggles for the public broadcasting sector has been that it was always configured to be a mix of private and public support. So there was never an expectation that federal dollars would fully subsidize the public media sector. And increasingly, especially in the 1980s, when the Federal Communications Commission allowed enhanced underwriting, local and national entities within the public media sector relied on corporate underwriting, or they relied on donations from community members, especially well-heeled, you know, affluent community members. And this has been often a question of survival for the sector, but what that's also meant is that probably the communities who would most benefit from a diverse, robust public media sector would get shortchanged because the very survival of the sector relied on courting particular audiences. And so one of the anxieties I have moving forward is that dynamic will only become more intense. So communities that have affluent listeners and viewers, their stations will probably be okay. Those that are able to court sufficient corporate underwriting for their programming, that will probably persist. But that's not really public media in the way that we would want it to operate, which is serving the diversity of all communities and providing programming not just to affluent viewers, but to all viewers and listeners who want to be informed, who want to be connected to their community, who want to see themselves represented in the media.
I've been thinking a lot about the reckoning that happened after the murder of George Floyd, and so many people in the public media world started speaking started advocating. Some people spoke anonymously about what is happening at their stations, about how there are still so few people of color in management roles in public media. And of course, the backlash was so intense. And to think, Joe, that a lot of that work, I mean, it's still so important, but a lot of people have lost their jobs. And I just wonder, because of these cuts, a lot of the first people to go tend to be people of color in public media. And I think we're just starting to really have that conversation again. Who's going to keep their job? Who's not? Whose voices are we going to hear? What stories are we going to tell? What are you thinking about that right now? How are you thinking about that right now?
This has always historically been true, especially we've seen it in traditional legacy media when consolidation happens, even during good times when companies were making a lot of profit, but they wanted to maximize it. They started cutting staff despite healthy profit margins. And then they were cutting black and brown folks who were newer in newer positions and stuff like that. And then the same thing is happening, obviously, with the decline in journalism. And so for me, you know, personally, you know, and for the work I'm currently doing, the Media 2070 project, which is a media reparations project, and reparations means redress. Mm-hmm. And the struggle with our media system is we have not dealt with the racial hierarchy that has existed in our media system since its origin, you know, and the history of anti-Black, anti-Indigenous racism, anti-Latino, like all the hierarchies that existed. And so our media system does not live outside of the American, so-called American story. It's centered into the racial hierarchies that have been built. It's been central to that project, right? And it's what our book documents, that's what my colleagues and I in BD 2070 document within our essays, trying to have a more of an analysis of like these other structural faults that exist in our media system. And it's only been in the past 50 or plus years, you know, since the mid 60s, where there was even a potential to integrate these places. And so we integrate all these institutions, but at the same time, these are, when you talk about traditional media we're talking about the structural challenges with public media, it's like they're not institutions that are serving, these are institutions that continue to fail often, fail to serve the Black and brown communities, and but stories they do tell that hurt the community or stories they don't tell that should help the community. And so, meanwhile, we're continuing to try. And meanwhile, our own institutions, like Black and Brown, you think about the Black press and how it's been in crisis for a long time financially, right? A lot of Black journalists, when they started integrating newsrooms, went to the more dominant mainstream press, right? And so we have not. And so one of the reasons we argue we're here is because the narratives and the role that media plays in shaping culture and society. What is the media system we need to exist in a so-called multiracial democracy, right? And we currently have not redressed the history of how our media system was built. And those fault lines stayed with us. And those are the places that over the past, you know, since we say all those folks signed the open letter about public media, and there was this all this discussion, the public media, the NYC and all that. This administration is attacking race and DEI. It's a fault line that's easily exploited and going after all these institutions. And so, it just shows the work in order to recapture, we have to reconstruct something different. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a long-term project, but we have to think about it in that kind of way in the solutions we're fighting for.
Mm. Yeah. Allison, what are your thoughts on that? And then you can share your final thoughts, and about a minute and a half left.
Sure. So I agree with everything that Joe just said, and I think it's really vital. And his comments apply both to the commercial sector and to the public media sector, where racial discrimination has been a part of the history of public media. Something I wrote about in my first book is very unusual in the history of US media for a broadcaster to have its license revoked. And one of the only broadcasters to lose a license on racial discrimination grounds were the public television stations in Alabama, which in the late 60s and 70s refused to air any programming that dealt with people of color, with civil rights, had no employees who were Black, did not work with any of the HBCUs in the state. And stories like that, I think, reframe how we understand the politics of public media and the real diversity that happens on the ground at individual stations in terms of how they operate and who gets to participate in the shaping of the stories that we all listen to and share and the narratives that structure how we understand ourselves in the world. I guess if it's okay, I'll just very last comment is, you know, that the cuts to public media are happening within a larger context of pretty staggering capitulation of media companies to harassment by the Trump administration, which only really augments this crisis over responsible journalism and holding power to account if we don't have media institutions that are willing to stand up for freedom of the press, for strong journalism, and for being critical of institutions and being especially critical of the current administration.
We actually got an email about Paramount canceling The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and so we're going to talk about that next week, and we'll talk about corporate media outlets capitulating to Trump. And Allison, thank you for sharing that tidbit about the history of what happened in Alabama, you know, at a time when this administration is going to great lengths to whitewash history. This kind of information is just more important than ever. So thank you. Allison Perlman is Associate Professor and Director of Undergraduate Studies in the Department of Film and Media Studies at UC Irvine, author of Public Interests, Media Advocacy and Struggles Over U.S. Television. Joe Torres is Senior Advisor at Free Press and Media 2070. He's co-author of News for All the People, The Epic Story of Race and the American Media. Joe and Allison, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.